Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order pursuant to House Rule 10.01. Today, we have three bills on the agenda, and the first order of business is to take the roll call. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll.
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Banner's on the way. Lead Albright?
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
I see you. It's okay. Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Moeller. Representative
Present.
Noor. Oh, thank you. Representative Noor. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Good morning. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, sir. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Let's see. Representative Sandel, would you like to move the minutes from March 12th? You're muted. Representative Sandel, would you try again? Thanks.
I have read the minutes, Madam Chair, and I move their adoption. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandel moves the minutes from March 12th. Any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Let's see, the first bill up for consideration is House File 1382. First, we need to move the division report. Chair Fisher, would you like to move the division report? Oh, this isn't your division, sorry. I'm going to move the division report from Preventing Homelessness. This is a voice vote. All those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report from Preventing Homelessness is adopted. So members, House File 1382 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. And the policy portion of the bill was discussed extensively in our division. So we will focus on the highlights of the bill and then talk about the fiscal implications if we have a fiscal note. So Representative Cagle, welcome back to our committee. Please present your bill now that's in front of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for hearing House File 1382 to provide increased funding for long-term homelessness supportive services funds. We've talked a lot over the past year about how the pandemic has shined a bright spotlight on how lack of investment in support services has exacerbated the problems faced by those challenged by housing instability, mental illness, chemical dependency, and chronic health issues. The Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund was created to encourage collaboration amongst public and private sector providers to work with individuals with long histories of homelessness and barriers to housing and break them down. In 2005, the legislature invested in the Long-Term Homelessness Support Services Fund. And despite what we all know, there are growing needs, and we currently invest just under $14 million per biennium. So House File 1382 is aggressive in proposing an increase of $7 million per year, so $14 million per biennium. But we introduced that amount to have an honest discussion with the committee on how much the cost of living has increased since the fund's creation. I recognize that choices will need to be made, and I think this is important for the committee to have a discussion on the statewide unmet needs as we, you know, are putting our budgets together. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Warren Duncan, who is the program director for Hearth Connection.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Mr. Duncan, please introduce yourself to the committee and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Warren Duncan, and as stated, I am a program director for Hearth Connection. I've been affiliated with this fund for a long time in various roles working with Hearth Connection and with provider partners. Since 2006, I've been a case manager, I've been a regional manager, and now I'm program director. Hearth Connection is celebrating over 22 years of working in housing and support services. Our history is rooted in a pilot program that looked at examining the most effective ways to work across sectors to assist individuals with a long history of homelessness who face incredible barriers to housing, whether that be mental health or chemical dependency. We were founded out of a pilot program that's demonstrated that the best way to help people with multiple barriers is to break down those complexities in an integrated way that connects healthcare, social services, affordable housing supports, innovative financing, centralized oversight, and emphasizing collaboration among partners. This work has helped us reach across traditional divides to truly help people find stability while reducing the cost associated with uncoordinated responses to homelessness. It was the initial data from the pilot program that interested the legislature in 2005 to create and fund the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. Hearth Connection has leveraged those funds for the last 16 years to be the mortar that holds many of the programs funded with traditional funding streams together. The Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund has proven to be an important stream of funding for us to bridge the work of federal, state, county, local community agencies, and other stakeholders. I'd like to take a minute to touch on some of the various aspects of our work with a couple key outcomes in each area. We have worked with four regional projects that have 1,723 participants across 46 counties. We've paired that with $6.5 million in rental assistance. And we see a $169 average a month increase in participant income for enrollees. We also have various special programs such as Step Down. This is a project with Minnesota Housing to move participants from high support site-based permanent supportive housing programs into the community with just a light touch. There is 7,443 annual savings per household compared to those traditional sites. We also work with a coordinated entry navigation services, and this program connects persons awaiting referrals into housing and other mainstream resources. It provides supports. There can be self-resolution when possible because of these supports. We also fund a coming home program where we partner with a healthcare agency, and that program has seen an 87% decrease in emergency room visits and an 88% decrease in inpatient hospital stays. Currently, Hearth Connection receives $5.5 million annually from the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. In 2020, Hearth Connection distributed roughly $4.9 million of the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund, which unlocked an additional $1.64 million from other funding sources, including federal HUD dollars, Medicaid funds like Adult Mental Health Targeted Case Management Services, and Adult Rehab Mental Health Services, otherwise known as ARMS. And in 2021, we are working on leveraging housing stabilization services to be paired with this fund. The magic of what the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund does is that it allows us to flexibly meet the needs of complex situations in ways that produce real outcomes. A funding increase would allow us to work with regions to expand capacities and also work to expand into more regions throughout the state that we know have populations that need help escaping long-term homelessness. Thank you, committee, for giving me time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Members, we'll proceed to questions right now, so please raise your hand if you have a question. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Duncan. I had a couple questions for you. One is, I note that there have been some, you know, positive things happening. I'm wondering if there is any documented analysis on the performance over the past 15 years of this fund.
Yes.
Duncan?
Yes. I mean, we currently have reports that we provide to the counties and to the Department of Human Services as showing kind of the outcomes and the metrics. And I guess it may help to understand as far as like what particular outcome are you wanting to know?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Duncan, well, I think one of the objectives of housing homelessness supports is that they not stay there, right? That they move on into more permanent housing, which also entails self-support, which would, you know, whether they have co-occurring, you know, dependencies, how we're addressing those, but also workforce development for that individual. So I'm curious in terms of those kind of corollaries to preventing the homelessness, you know, security and shelter, how that would be documented. And if so, has it been or could you provide it to the legislature?
We can certainly provide copies of outcomes as far as with the program, as far as access to housing and housing stability. One thing I think to note with the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund too, when we think of programs traditionally in the model, we have this front door and we have this back door as far as for supports. Who this fund targets are individuals that have the most barriers. And so there's not necessarily a time limit on the program eligibility. It's no time limit for supports. Some individuals that come in have very high barriers. And what we do is we bring in those wraparound supports for them to be able to stay stably housed no matter what. And the quality of their life does improve. And we do track that through a matrix, self-sufficiency matrix assessment, which again, we can provide the data to show that improvement. They may not necessarily achieve self-sufficiency, but that doesn't mean that's not what they're working on. Because again, these are individuals that have the highest barriers, the longest histories of homelessness. Representative, did that help answer your question?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Duncan, yes, it does. I think if the report kind of identifies the reduction in terms of long-term homelessness from your perspective and how we've been able to achieve or provide, you know, those wraparound services, whether they be for chemical dependency, kind of recidivism for corrections or other, you know, services. But I'm really pointing on, you know, that self-sufficiency. And I appreciate what you're saying about that it may not be accomplished, but they are working towards it. And I know that's a kind of a nebulous definition that, you know, you can't get your outcomes around. But, you know, progress, I think, can be documented. And I'm sure that that's something that you have experienced. And I would just look forward to those reports. I share Representative Cagle's desire. I just want to make sure that we as stewards of the funds that have been provided to the state are diligent about making sure that we are being good stewards. Certainly appreciate your yeoman service on this program and look forward to those reports. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I would encourage members to go back and stream the hearing that the division had with this bill, because we had a testifier from Duluth, Lee Stewart. And we've had really a great success with this model in Steve O'Neill Apartments, and you can hear her testimony and how it saved our city and county significant amount of money just in reducing ER utilization and public safety, reductions in public safety dollars. So it doesn't not only helps individuals who are being housed and provide services, but it just reduces the need of our public safety and our hospitalizations and ER. And I believe reporting is required in this bill. So I don't know if Representative Cagle wants to talk about the base funding and then the reporting requirements. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the base funding right now is $13.8 million per biennium. And I think Mr. Duncan can probably, I mean, he's better at the reporting requirements.
Mr. Duncan, can you describe the reporting requirements that are contained in the bill?
I can do my best. One thing at Hearth Connection is we bring together the resources, so it's not just the long-term homeless supportive service fund, but we pair it together, and then we handle all the administrative work and reporting that's associated with like the rental assistance and the long-term homeless supportive service fund. And so as far as the reporting requirements, the reporting requirements for the long-term homeless supportive service fund are set by DHS. I believe someone's here, maybe they can, the details escape me, so I apologize, help better answer that.
Okay, is there a member from DHS available to talk about the reporting requirements of House File 1382? Mr. Leary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Leary, and I work with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm the program manager for the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund. And our current reporting requirements, we utilize the Minnesota Homeless Management Information System, and we collect extensive data on the program. So I'd be glad to try to answer any more specifics on that that reporting mechanism.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leary, is that report or those ongoing reports, are those delivered or provided to the chairs and the ranking members of the various committees that would be responsible to the fund?
Madam Chair, Representative, currently there is no requirement to provide a report to the legislature. I understand there was an amendment to the bill last hearing that would require us to provide some information in a report form to the legislature, but we'd be happy. I think we're happy to agree to report any of the information that we collect to the legislature if desired.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leary, just a final question. How many homeless support service providers are involved in this program?
Mr. Leary?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, we currently have 7 projects across the state. They are multi-county and multi-tribal collaboratives. The funding has to go through either a county or a tribe, and then it's passed. Most of the projects employ an intermediary, which then does the administrative work of implementing the program. And then they in turn choose the service providers that will actually deliver the services to the participants. And right now we have about 42 service providers across the state that provide those services directly to participants.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leary, is there any cap in terms of the amount of the grant funding on the base that is allowable for administering the programs? Is there a certain percentage, either at the state level or the county level, that caps what can be utilized out of the funding base?
Mr. Leary?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have had a longstanding agreement with the grantee counties that they not take an administrative allowance out of the program. They in turn pass that administrative allowance on to the intermediaries, and we have I wouldn't say it's a hard and fast administrative cap, but it's recommended at 10% of the funding. And if a particular project needs to exceed that 10%, they need to request a waiver from us to, not a legal waiver, but a permission to exceed that 10%.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the $13 million in the base funding, just as an example, that would suggest that administrative costs might but can't exceed $1.3 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Leary?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that would be correct.
Ms. Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, does the reporting mechanism that you provide to the various agencies in the past, does it then document what amount of administrative cost there has been from the base appropriation in years past?
Mr. Leary?
Madam Chair, Representative, that information would be documented in the fiscal reporting that we require of the projects. They submit a quarterly report every month, and one of the cost categories would be administration, and that's how we would keep track of the administrative costs.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Representative Albright, last question before we get
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. This is a good program, and the narrative that I would have ended on is just being diligent to the overall cost for the program. It is a bit disconcerting that not to exceed 10% can go towards the adjudication of these grants within this program. I would certainly urge, nay, admonish Mr. O'Leary to take a close look at that. We're bound to be good stewards of the money that the taxpayers sent to us. Notwithstanding the virtues, albeit them good intent for this program, Representative Cagle, I see you're nodding your head in agreement that I think it's important that we be mindful of making sure that the most possible is getting to the people with the most need. And so I would just urge members to keep that in mind as we walk through the next several weeks with regard to the finances of the state, but also for the stakeholders. Mr. Duncan, thank you for your testimony today. And then thank you for the work that you do. And Mr. Leary, appreciate this, but we all need to be making sure that it makes sense in terms of that we're delivering good for the benefit of those in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. Duncan, can you comment on that? We don't have verification that it's 10% is taken. Can you describe your experience?
As the administration of four of those collaboratives, we collect our fee through pass-through of the dollars that we have to the direct service providers. Part of the role that we have also is to not that of the traditional funder in grants, but to be just in the weeds with the local community agencies who are doing the direct service work. And so we, the pass-through funds pay for staff to be able to provide those appropriate supports to be able to do the grant and to pay for, we have our own data collection tool that we use for payments and to kind of show what the outcomes are with the programs.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Representative Cagle, I'm not seeing any more questions. Closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. In the Preventing Homelessness Division, we did adopt the reporting requirements to the legislature, so that will now be part of it going forward. And I also just kind of want to point to a story that was on in the Star Tribune on March 13th. The headline was, "We Save Lives, How Isolating Minnesota's Homelessness Kept Them Safe from COVID-19. But the article also goes into detail about how some of the support services for mental health and addiction have helped people. And so it's kind of been, a silver lining, I guess, in this whole thing is that we're really starting to, see how safe homes, safe places to stay, can also help get people on the track to, you know, addressing some of their mental health, addiction issues. And so I think that is really the goal that we want, is to make sure that people are have a place to lay their heads and are taking care of themselves. And so with that, I just really appreciate the conversation and hope we can get this to the end. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Cagle, for working on this bill. We appreciate it. So with that, members, House File 1382 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Okay, the next item for consideration is House File 635. House File 635, as a reminder, members, we heard this last month, and it was laid over. I'm bringing it back here, and we're going to amend it to talk about, this is the school-linked mental health grants dollars, and it was a blank appropriation. And now we're looking at an amendment that Representative Bierman is bringing forward to fund mental health initiatives in our schools for this year. So I'm going to move to have House File 635 be in front of our committee, and it will also be laid over for possible inclusion after the amendment. I see we have Representative Bierman here. Would you like me to move the A1 amendment before we talk about the bill, Representative Bierman?
Please.
Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment be adopted. This is a voice vote, and then we'll go to the amendment, which is adding to the appropriations in House File 635. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Two-year bill or amendment, as amended, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Thanks for taking up the bill again and considering this amendment. I just wanted to review just what the bill was. It wasn't too long ago that you heard it, and I think most members are very familiar with the program. So as you recall, school-linked mental health funding was first established in 2007, with funding going out the door in 2008. And the grant money goes to community mental health providers who then co-locate in the schools. Grant funds are used to provide treatment to children who are uninsured and underinsured, and to work with school support personnel and teachers to build the capacity of the school to address the mental health needs of all students. So the provider bills private and public insurance, and the mental health records are kept separate from educational records. The provider can also provide care when school is not in session. So it's important to note, members, that this program builds on the work that the school support personnel perform in the schools, and it's critical that we have both. Barriers, including transportation needs, busy schedules, open therapy times during non-school hours, can prevent children from receiving adequate treatment. And school-linked mental health services help eliminate these barriers to school-aged children receiving mental health supports through licensed providers. This bill has a blank appropriation to the Department of Human Services to fund the program through 2022, and adds it to the base. And it sets aside 25% of the appropriation to go to schools that contain the highest number of students with special needs, who are categorized as having emotional and behavioral disorders, or schools with high poverty rates. Commissioner is directed to distribute the grants to rural and urban counties. So the amendment adds an additional appropriation of $6 million to what was appropriated for the fiscal year 2021 school year to support children and makes staff eligible to access services. Adding this appropriation to this bill will expand these grants to serve approximately 8,100 students in more than 1,100 Minnesota school sites. Members, the mental health of our students was a growing challenge before the worldwide pandemic, as you know. As we plan next steps, this bill and amendment will address the continuing needs that we must meet. Madam Chair, I do not have any testifiers, but the Legislative Director of Community Supports from DHS is present, Ms. Christy Grammi, to assist with any questions that members may have, please.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And just the amendment adds $6 million for the school-linked mental health to start this year, and part of that money would go to teachers and staff. to questions. Representative Robbins. Hope you're muted, Representative Robbins.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Berman. I've heard a lot of great things about this program since I became elected from my school. So, you know, I'm very much inclined to support this, but I don't fully understand it. So I had a couple questions. First, are parents notified when children are participating in getting services through SchoolLink Mental Health? And, you know, if so, right away or at the end of the school year, how does that work? And secondly, if we're allowing staff to access this, is that temporary or is that going to be forever? And how are staff prioritized versus students who need help? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I think, Representative Bierman, I'll direct that to Ms. Grom from DHS.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Grom, please introduce yourself to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm the Legislative Director for Community Supports at the Department of Human Services. It's my understanding that parents need to consent to mental health services provided in the school in the same manner that they would consent to services in the community. And in terms of how the, I think the second part of your question, Representative, was how much money was allocated toward teachers and staff, and then how much was for students. So there's $5 million of the appropriation is for students, and then an additional $1 million is for teachers and staff, and this is one-time funding. I believe it expires July 2022.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Just one quick follow-up. So are we going to be using federal money for this since it's one-time money? And I'm assuming that there's federal money available for schools that could be used for this, or is this state money?
Ms. Grom or Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, the bill as it stands appropriates general fund dollars, as did the governor for this request in his budget.
Thank you.
Any follow-up, Representative Robbins? No. Okay. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a program that I was actually on a school board when we started doing this. In our local schools. And I like the fact that we could kind of work with parents to help our students be successful, because the one constant that goes through school between kindergarten and senior high is a parent. And so I think it's really important that we work with families to help a child who's really struggling mental health wise, and it's a team. The family is a team, with the school being an assistant, and I think it's really important that. So I support this program. I think it's helpful, but I wonder, with all that I hear about mental health problems and children struggling, we've still got children not in school. Who are at low risk, and I really think that would be helpful to identify children that have mental health problems to begin with, by having them in school, helping them to normalize their life as best that it can be. And I just really see this as an emotional mental health problem that we do not have children in school. And I kind of wonder, it's only an expansion for the one school year, are we going to be hearing about this again? Are we going to need to fund more in the future because of the troubles that we had? I guess you answered my other question. So anyway, let's go with that. Why are we doing just FY 2022?
Ms. Grom or Representative Bierman?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So this program has just been re-upped every biennium since 2008. So it's going to be continually funded as we go, as I understand it. I don't think we're going to go longer term, but you're absolutely right. The need for it is great and certainly increasing. And you made a good point about, you know, the fact that you know, parents are involved and this is a family. Speaking with my school counselors and school administrators, I think that's the sense that they're trying to imbue in their student body and in their buildings, is that students and teachers and counselors are a family, and that's really what they're trying to cultivate. And the needs of the kids extend beyond what they're trying to teach them in the school. They identify these kids, they know their needs, they know some of their backgrounds, and you know, it's a learning process for the teachers who are certainly, you know, tied to those students in ways that are, you know, very close relationships and a lot of concern. And their mental health and well-being is one big part of that. So it is something that I think we will continue to need to address here at the legislature as legislators who see the need and talk to our local schools officials and understand what they need to help make this program better for them. You know, this one school linked part of it is really only a small part of what they're dealing with on mental health issues in the school building. And they say, you know, that what they really want is, in some cases, more counselors in the building to deal with the needs of those kids on a daily basis. And the school linked is great. They'll take the help, but it's not the solution, of course. And it's just another piece of what we could try to do. So hope that answered part of your question, but any more, please.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I appreciate that. I think I was misunderstood. When I consider family, I consider mom and dad and child. Now, I understand that some children are going to need to be removed, or there's going to be some other solutions, just because children, there are some serious concerns out there. But what I want to impress is, as a mother, watching grandchildren, watching being on the school board, the one constant is mom and dad and family. And while teachers are wonderful and have a real important part in children's lives and are influential, and they're important to helping a child develop, mom and dad are the constant. And so if they don't finish high school, if they don't, if something else happens, there's still that family. So I really want to see us work as teachers, counselors, not have so many counselors, but have parents be part of that discussion about whether it is your mental health, or maybe you have some, I have nephews that are autistic, and parents have had trouble figuring out the guidance. Some parents do really well at it, some do not. But I really think our goal needs to work with parents rather than apart from. And I know there's friction, and it is scary sometimes as a teacher to have your parent come in. My husband's 6'3", and he came in to question a classroom one time, the teacher, at a parent-teacher conference, and she was probably 5 foot. 100 pounds dripping wet. And I could see the fear in her eyes immediately when he asked the question. He was kind of serious. So I know he's intimidating. But after a little bit of conversation, we figured out we were all on the same page. And that's what I think is more important. And teachers, I know, would tell you that it is really important that we work together to help that child be successful and seek a career. So while I think that this is a great program and helping families, especially with mental health issues that we don't understand, I think it just really helps the parents to help that child be successful. So I hope that's my concern, is that I'm supportive of it, but I'm a little concerned that we would cut out parents and that team for that child. So.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Keel. And I hope with what I said that I certainly didn't mean to impinge on any of that strong and necessary and obvious first bond of parent and child. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. I would just like to add that I think we need to be very inclusive when we talk about a definition of family and family members and the support structure that our young learners need. And I also will say that this is part of a much larger package that Governor Walz and the Minnesota Department of Education are supporting to start summer initiatives. So I believe the ask is $150 million, and it would support summer programs, field trips, this mental health piece, and funding for graduating seniors for college courses. So this is a bigger package that's going to be moving through different committees, and we're hearing this mental health piece. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Representative Bierman. In the amendment, I have a couple questions about that, and I see Ms. Bailey's on the line from DHS, but on line 1.7 of your amendment, which we've adopted now, it says increase access to federal grants. And I'm wondering if we could be a little more specific in terms of, is that a 50-50 match? Is it, a 90-10? What is the nature of the accessibility to additional federal grant money that you speak of on that line?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. We should turn to DHS for that answer on a percentage. I would be guessing just to say what I think it is, but I guess I would rather hear from the department on that.
Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. I'm not certain what the answer is to that, and so I'll have to go back and get that information and provide it to you and the committee following this hearing.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, going back to your amendment on line 1.8, I've read your bill, and I certainly understand the context, but in the line 1.8, you say provide additional outside one-on-one mental health supports to students. The word outside can certainly be defined in terms of outside the confines of the building of a school. It could also be defined as a third-party entity contracted to provide those support services. So just wondering if you could define what outside means.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Albright, yes. To me, outside means that the professional mental health services are from outside the school. And so this would be referring to the professional outside services that are brought into the school to co-locate to do the provide the mental health services.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, as a former minor in English, I would certainly urge you to maybe refine that word to mean exactly what you just suggested. I certainly support that, but I think for others that might be reading that, it might, legislative intent sometimes has to go back to the record, but if we don't have to do that and we can put it into the body of the legislation, I think it's always much a better attitude to take. Going further, Madam Chair, if you indulge me, on line 1.13, Representative Bierman, I note that you're setting aside $1 million to provide mental health supports to teachers and other school staff. And I certainly recognize that COVID and others, other circumstances relevant to the school day and the past school year have certainly affected teachers and their staff as well. But I'm wondering, since this is focused on children, why it is included or bifurcated out of the overall grant when it wouldn't it also be more appropriate to consider this as part of the collective bargaining agreement that those teachers have in providing supports for them as opposed to this, which is supporting to the students, which is that name students is well seasoned throughout the amendment as well as the bill. But then you include teachers and staff in the body of it, of your amendment. So I'm just curious what the intent there is if it's for schools or is it for students?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. The bill itself and the amendment is for schools. And this is the first time that I'm aware of that teachers or staff, so this includes staff beyond the teachers in the building, people in the building would have access to this. And I think that in the whole scheme of things of the education profession right now, I think that allowing teachers to access some mental health counseling would be strengthening our buildings and our teams in the schools. Teachers, as you know, experience high turnover, they experience burnout, they experience things in schools that, you know, if they have that access and they don't have to make their own appointments outside the building and take time off from work and go there to get the services, and, you know, their insurance may cover the cost of this anyway, so it would be billed directly to their provider. I think that would, this is, I think, an important part of the bill, and I think it's a something that hasn't been done before, to my knowledge. Perhaps Ms. Crommie could correct me if I'm incorrect on that, but I think having been on ed policy the last term and having been out to the schools and mixed with administrative and counselors and having a teacher, my daughter, in her first year of teaching here in Minnesota, I think the mental health and well-being of our teaching staff is very important, and I'm glad that it's included in the bill. And thank you for the question.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final point, and I understand that this bill is being laid over. My observations, just from what Representative Bierman said, is I'm sure education policy is probably, you know, kind of the one of the largest focal points of any budgetary session. But yet this bill is not being heard before either of those committees, and we've debated that point on other bills. I don't see that it's been heard by them. You can certainly comment on that if you wish. But my final question for either Representative Bierman or for Ms. Grom is, in the origination of the bill on line 1.12, starting on 1.10, it talks about the highest percentage of special education students categorized as having an emotional and behavioral disorder, and that the grants will be distributed to rural and urban counties. And I apologize if I'm going over ground, gold ground, but how is that assessment or that threshold observed? Where is the beginning of that threshold for high poverty? And how do we do that? Is that a pro rata by population, or is it based upon the EBD score for every school district? Could you just elaborate on what that means as you're appropriating this grant money and asking for the governor's budget request?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright, for the question. I think we'll request some help on where the lines are if they have those. I think taking the state and calculating, you know, how many students in a given year are in those programs is obviously the point of departure, but what that looks like from a broader perspective and results, I'm not exactly certain. Perhaps Ms. Crommie could assist us in that area.
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe we work with the Department of Education to get that data and assess it. And I do have one of our policy experts, Ms. Singh, with us that might be able to better respond to that question for the committee.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that name, Ms. Grom?
Ms. Singh.
Ms. Singh, please introduce yourself to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Vija Singh, and I am the Clinical Behavioral Health Director for Community Support Administration for DHS. And as Ms. Graham said, we are in working in coordination with MDE to look for like specifics on the data to identify and make sure that our children and families who are desperately in need of these services get it. Besides the fact that we know that kids and families who are on Medicaid really meet that income eligibility criteria of poverty guidelines. We, in fact, got a position funded through federal grant. It is a 0.5 data position that is working in close collaboration with MBE to develop a statewide waiting list so we can get a better idea and some numbers to make sure that we are reaching to the kids who are really in need of services. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Singh. And I'll just add that, you know, the path of this bill, pieces of it were taken so we could just hear that section of the larger bill. And Chair Dabney is leading the effort in education finance, and we'll be hearing the final legislation. And it'll be in front of various committees, Representative Albright, and will be vetted extensively. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman. First, I want to say, as a longtime teacher and coach in the elementary and secondary schools, that in-school health clinics providing the support for mental health and well-being of families is terrific, and an enormous support for the teaching and for the emotional growth and stability of the children as well. Representative Keel, I think that the most successful of those programs and most effective of those programs have always involved the caregivers and the families who support and love the children and want to see them succeed, and I certainly agree with you. And Representative Albright, I worked at the university for a while, and the university provided a mental health counseling for their faculty and staff, and it was Chair Schultz, if it's available at UMD as well as it was at the Twin Cities campus, but it was a support for many people, and personally, it was a tough time for me, and I used the services, and was grateful for them. Representative Bierman, I've been working with an organization called the Minnesota Alliance of School-Based Clinics, and I'm sponsoring a bill, House File 2176, that would seem to have a lot in common with your work, and I wonder if we could talk offline, maybe with Chair Schultz as well, about that. Thanks very much, committee, for the chance to mention those concerns. Thanks, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Representative Sandel. Okay, Representative Bierman, any closing comments?
Just a thank you to Ms. Grammy and Ms. Singh for being here to help out on the bill, and thank you again to members for listening and adding some really good input or questions and more things to think about as this bill moves forward. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this bill and the amendment. So with that, members, House File 635 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, members, the last bill for consideration is House File 1437. House File 1437 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Welcome, Representative Hansen, to the committee. I believe this bill is extending some executive orders to make it easier for applying for benefits, and if you could describe the bill, that would be wonderful. We have various folks from DHS that are here available for questions from members. So welcome, thank you, Ms. Hansen, for being here with us and to present your bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And you're correct, I would like to move that HF 1437 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Omnibus Bill. Today, I will provide a brief overview of this agency bill, and we have no testifiers, though Jennifer Sommerfeld, Nicholas Dam, and Deborah Schlick from DHS are here with us to answer questions if needed. I'd also like to take a second to thank Senators Hoffman, Yutke, and Abler for carrying this companion bill in the Senate. Members, there are three parts of the process for an individual to receive services through the Minnesota Family Investment, or MFIP, program and the Diversionary Work Program, also called DWP. This bill discusses the applications, interviews, and orientation steps. This bill ensures agencies can conduct these steps by telephone and or internet telepresence. These changes will reduce the barriers for children and their families as they apply for MFIP and DWP services. This bill requires local agencies that administer MFIP and DWP to accept applications over the phone or through internet telepresence. MFIP and DWP are the only public assistance programs that require a face-to-face application and orientation process. This bill also empowers local agencies that administer MFIP and DWP to allow mandatory applicant interviews to be conducted by telephone. And I ask members to keep in mind that we already have face-to-face or internet interviews. So this bill really just adds phone to that. COVID-19 has illuminated the need for increased accessibility and portability in public programs. We know that folks eligible for these programs are often facing a variety of barriers and trauma. Increasing accessibility to these programs is an act of honoring their inherent dignity and worth of the people who are eligible for these programs. It's a follow through on our commitment to empower our staff and agencies to best assist individuals who need these services. This bill is the continuation of the flexibility from CB.03 put in place at the beginning of COVID-19, and the legislature extended these provisions from CB03 through June 30th, 2021, and this legislation seeks to make this extension permanent. That's my bill, Madam Chair. I thank you all for hearing this, and I'll turn it over for questions.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. We were learning a lot from the pandemic, and we're learning about how to be more efficient and to reduce some of the barriers for applying for our program. So we appreciate you working on this with our agency. I have one question. So does this, for a phone-based application, do they still have to have something in writing as a follow-up, Rep. Hansen?
Madam Chair, that is my understanding that those signed applications still do need to be submitted. This just allows some of the initial information to be collected on the phone. I can defer to DHS to maybe give you a more experienced answer on that as well.
Yes, thank you. Let's see, Ms. Schlick, could you answer that question and give us more information about how that's been working currently?
Representative Schultz and Representative Hansen. I'm Deborah Schlick. I work at the Minnesota Department of Human Services in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division. And Representative Hansen has it right. All the language about getting a signed application is still in place, and no assistance can be issued if a signed application hasn't been received.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, with the advent of telehealth and with the inclusion of the waiver that would include a telephone interview, pointedly, could an applicant never have to complete a personal face-to-face interview and still obtain MFIP benefits?
Representative Hansen, would you like Ms. Schlick to answer that?
Madam Chair, I think that Ms. Schlick is best suited to answer that question. Representative Albright, I just want to defer to folks who do this every single day to give you the best answer.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright. It could be feasible that someone does not have a face-to-face interview with their eligibility worker in some, it seems, unusual cases. A reminder that Minnesota Family Investment Program has work requirements, which include meeting with an employment counselor, signing an employment plan, and following through on the employment plan. So there's another important worker in the operation of the MFIP program. That would be hard to imagine that all of that could happen without a face-to-face discussion with the employment services worker, and those would be much more frequent than just applying.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Schlick. But it is possible that a creative individual might be able to navigate the person without presenting themselves in person to document almost like I'm not a robot kind of a thing on the internet and receive benefits, even notwithstanding the work requirement interview, as to your use your words, correct?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright. So one clarification, the ability to have these conversations over internet telepresence is already existing in law. It is the option to do it by telephone for people who don't have internet that is new. The assumption of the internet telepresence is that it's something like what we're doing now, where we're seeing and talking to each other. And then let me follow up with what the heart of your question was. So it is possible that all the contact could be over the phone or through internet telepresence in some cases.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Albright.
No further questions, Madam Chair, but I do think that it is important that we are vigilant about making sure that in some way, shape, or form that individuals present themselves face-to-face, either through telepresence or otherwise, to ensure the integrity of the system, that the impersonation or otherwise fraud, if you will, is not being perpetrated because of a loophole that we hadn't thought of in our desire to be supportive of people that are seeking these benefits. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz, Representative Albright, I should have explained more thoroughly in my answer that residence and address are one of the things that have to be verified in the application process, no matter how the application interview occurs.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just some things crossed my mind when we're having this conversation. It actually comes to a job of employment that was a nursing home. So you'll all understand the desperate need of the employee who was on MFIT. And I don't know, this has been over a year ago because it was before COVID, where they spent the 6 weeks training this person. And I realize this is a little on the side of this conversation, Representative Hansen. So, but my concern is that they were able to work for 6 weeks, the training portion, and then left. And there was very little reporting from the facility. They were very frustrated because A, they had put 6 weeks into that person. But the other thing was, is he was an excellent employee as far as coming on time, doing his job. They were so thrilled to have somebody with such compassion and caring, and then walked away. So my concern is the same as Representative Albright's, that that we make sure that we have people accountable, that we know that the situation is what it is. Because I think there's a lot we can do, as we see through video all the time on different sites, the ability for people to pull the wool, as you would, over the eyes of somebody who's checking. And so I'm more than a little concerned about the fact that we are making sure that the integrity of the program is there. Because remember, we're not just helping people, but if someone is using it for bad purposes, they're taking it away from someone who needs it. There's only so many dollars, and I think we need to make sure that we're protecting those who need help rather than those who want to game the system, for lack of better words. So. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen and Ms. Schlick. I wanted to follow up on the verification part. I just simply don't know. So when someone applies over the phone, how do you actually verify their address, residence, income level, and how does that fit? I'm also concerned about fraud, and how does that fit with the commissioner's much beloved discussion of the swish swatch, so that every I is crossed and T dotted? Are we living up to the swish swatch theory with this new way of doing this? Thank you.
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Robbins. Because the interview is just one step in the application process, but that, again, no matter how that interview occurs, a written application and the required verifications have to be submitted, and that application has to be signed. We haven't changed any of the expectations on the people applying about how they verify their identity, they verify their address, they verify their relationship to their children, they verify any income they have. That all stays in place. The question is just whether the conversation to clarify that application happens in person, over the telephone, or through internet telepresence.
Thank you, Mishlik. Representative Robbins?
Thank you. And if you could just, in a little bit of detail, tell me how that stuff is verified.
Mishlik?
I don't know. Thank you.
Representative Schultz and Representative Robbins, I will tell you to the best of my ability, not having been a frontline worker. For instance, so people have to submit Social Security numbers. We verify those independently against information from the Social Security Administration. We ask for birth certificates. We ask for pay stubs. So we're always asking for a piece of paper or an electronic record that can establish that that what has been put on an application is true. The signature on the application comes after a statement that notifies the individual that the information on the application must be true, and if untrue, is subject to a fraud investigation and or criminal penalties.
Like Representative Hansen, did you want to add to that?
No, Madam Chair, I will defer to Ms. Schlick's answer here. I was a recipient of these services and as a teen mom, and I just remember having to over-verify so much. And there's just so much information that we put folks through to prove, you know, where they live, where they work, what they do, and it makes you very vulnerable. And so while I very much appreciate making sure that we're the Swiss watch, to Representative Robbins' analogy, that we're working on that, I just also want to, you know, keep in mind that the majority of folks who are receiving these services, these are springboards to the rest of their lives a lot of times. I wouldn't be sitting in front of you without access to services like this today. So I think it's really important that, yes, we make sure the Swiss watch runs efficiently, but we also make sure that we're making this accessible for folks like myself and so many others who, during these really hard times of their lives, don't have access to the internet, can't afford to go to do a face-to-face interview without risking losing their jobs. I think this is a great step that I wish would have been available when I was trying to juggle all of that. You just face these things with your employers, you know, that you have to, you know, tell them things that, you know, maybe you don't want to have to talk about. So I appreciate the question and the answers here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Robbins.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any more questions. Any closing comments, Representative Hansen?
Nope, I am good, Ms. Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing this. Thank you for taking the initiative to help us make sure we can meet more people where they're at and help more people find the help that they need and receive the services that are going to get them to the next step of where they're trying to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So with that, House File 1437 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. That concludes our agenda for today, members. Tomorrow we'll be meeting at a regular time at 10:30. We're going to be hearing, I believe, at least four bills from our Behavioral Health Division. And I hope to see everybody tomorrow and enjoy the rest of your day. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.